Hi, everybody. Good morning. Oh, it's a great thing to be here and to be welcomed by David Park. I was remembering him when I was still in seminary, and we were at that retreat down in Padre Island. You have to know it was in February, and the place was deserted. Padre Island in the summer is like, in the spring, is a hotbed of college kids and beer drinking and skimpy bathing suits, etc. But we were there in February, where the only thing to do was bird watching. And there was a hot tub there, I believe. And I met, speaking of incongruous meetings, I met John Weston, who is the head of the settlements office, which as a seminarian is like the most important person in the world, right? Because he directed the office that would someday help you find a church. So you wanted to make a good impression on John Weston. And we were lolling about in the hot tub before I realized who he was. It was a little, you know. But it was okay, you know, I look like a minister, my dad was a minister, I was not going to face significant problems entering into this field. I just have to remind myself that. You know, I started thinking about that tidal wave of justice that Seamus Heaney talked about a couple of years ago. I think I first heard the phrase from the lips of Joe Biden used to quote that poem, or still quotes that poem. But when I looked about a couple of years ago, I was seeing, you know, six social movements that were potentially remaking our social order. The movement for Black Lives, the movement for reproductive justice, the movement for immigrant rights, the movement for a $15 minimum wage, all the people mobilized for climate justice, both around the world and in their local community. That movement for transgender protection and affirmation. All those social movements seemed to be so strong and even ascendant. And I could imagine that we might reach a moment when hope and history would rhyme. And people talked about an ascendant America, a multiracial, multicultural, more diverse America coming to power. An America that had been converted from its idolatries. And all that seems now like a different world. Just a few years ago. But we still live in the same country. And all that same energy against racism, against injustice, against oppression and exploitation, that's still among us. It's just that we have been reminded that a social movement also exists that opposes all those energies. And after all, as we learned in physics class in our high schools a long time ago, every action creates an equal and opposing reaction. And that a social movement that opposes justice, inclusion, and progress has been empowered at the highest level. America is like two angry cats in a bag. So I have read about tidal waves, and one of the things I have learned is that before all that water comes rushing in, it first has to go out. Before a tsunami hits, the water along the shore is sucked away from the land, gathering its volume and power before it comes smashing back in. So they say if you're ever at the beach and all the water dramatically recedes from the shoreline, do not run out to collect seashells from the newly exposed ocean floor. That is the time you call Uber. Or a cab. Or figure out how to swim. So right now, I think that the water has pulled back from the shore. The tide has gone out and exposed a lot of things that were sunken and submerged before. Now, I did not anticipate this moment in time. A Trump presidency, with all that it has brought with it. But in retrospect, it was naive on my part to not expect something like this, an aggressive reassertion of the old ways, the old order, coming back, now injured and angry and desperate. America is two angry cats in a bag. So all those rising social movements from before the election, they're still around, except now we call them the resistance. Oh, to be alive at a time like this is a blessing. It's times like this, times that are scary, when things seem to be spinning out of control, that ordinary people have the chance to push the world toward change. What we do every day, how we choose to participate, where we put our time, where we put our attention is the most valuable resource in the world. People pay billions of dollars to get your attention and to keep your attention. It's amazing. And we just have it all day for free. Most of the time, mine is off wandering somewhere, but it is mine. Where do we contribute our money? How much hope we can muster? And whether we give in to cynicism and despair, at such a time as this, we make the world anew, and we make a new tomorrow. Now, there's a lot going on, a groundswell of civic engagement. I was preaching the other day at Bell Street Chapel in Providence, a little small, old church filled mostly with elderly folks, some young folks. I said, I just was reading in the paper that 800 people showed up to meet our congressional delegation. I thought that was quite amazing, and about 10 people out of that 50-member congregation were there. They said, yeah, we know. You don't have to tell us that. We were there. I said, I wasn't, but thank God you were. The switchboards at the U.S. Capitol are overwhelmed. Town hall meetings for members of Congress have been explosive. Fundraising for organizations that oppose retrogressive policies has been off the charts. The ACLU raised 3 times the amount of money they ordinarily raise in a year over the weekend of the first travel ban. And I know that my email inbox is stuffed. Page after page of organizations asking me to contribute, asking me to sign up on their mailing list. Specific invitations to marches and rallies and meetings. There's so many ways to get involved now. And now is the time to step into the stream of history. So my question this morning is, where do we as Unitarian Universalists, what do we have to offer? Someday I'll tell you a story about a sermon and a chalice. I think we don't have time for it now, but But where do we as Unitarian Universalists fit into this whole environment that's out there now among all these invitations? Why should a person, you know, somebody comes to you and goes, I want to get involved, but I don't know whether I should join Theodore Parker Unitarian Universalist Church or join Move On or Indivisible. Why should I do that? So I just want to talk about what we have to offer that's specifically and unique to us that we have to offer in this present environment. So the first thing is, well, it is our story. You know, when people don't ask anymore, what do you believe? They ask you what your story is, right? Because your story tells what counts. Now, when I was a child, back when the earth was young and all the animals spoke the same mother tongue, Unitarianism and Universalism was really defined by one idea. Actually, that idea was individual religious freedom. We were, for the most part, a very respectable, moderate, middle-of-the-road religious movement that had this rather odd idea that people in the pews should be free to believe or not believe whatever they wanted. We had some great social justice fighters, of course, you're named for one, but that was the exception, not the rule. Theodore Parker did not get along with his Unitarian colleagues of the day. So here we were, this moderate, respectable New England Republican, for the most part, religious movement, united around this one idea, individual religious freedom. When I was a young lad, that's what the First Unitarian Church in Youngstown, Ohio, that's what it was about. That's the unite. But that belief in freedom in some way led us into broad sympathy with the 1950s and 60s civil rights movement, which is actually quite odd when you look at it, because theologically we had nothing in common with the Black Baptist churches that were at the heart of that movement. We didn't agree with them theologically, but we saw how our idea, individual religious freedom, somehow connected into their struggle, enough so that Unitarians and Universalists committed themselves to that. Not everywhere, but certainly as a main thread. And then that commitment led us into alignment with all the other social movements of those days. Now, this is our story. We went from this individual religious freedom idea into this broad alignment with all these insurgent movements of people that we could see were fighting for freedom, the same freedom, maybe in a different form than what we were about. And eventually in the 1980s, following that path, that thread we were following, we put forward an idealistic and utopian view of how the world ought to work and how our congregations ought to work, because that was the same ideal. And we summarized those views in the 7 principles, which as fundamental theology is a little weak, ask any minister. But as public theology, is incredibly strong. But it's idealistic and utopian. It's a wonderful world. Everybody has worth and dignity. Freedom, equity, justice. Everything's interconnected. It's a wonderful world. The question is then, why doesn't that happen? Why is the world not like that? Why is that not the operating system of the world? It's not. So as soon as we adopted that idealistic utopian view, we were on to another question, which is, why isn't this true? You know, and then the thing that happened was the welcoming congregation process, right? We said everybody has worth and dignity. We are already in sympathetic with the gay movement, so we're saying, well, you know, come on in. We're all welcoming. And people said, well, no, not really. And what we learned was that oppression, the kind of exclusionary oppression that kept gay and lesbian, queer, bisexual, transgender people out of our churches, is a system, and we're implicated in it. It's not just the thoughts we think. It's our basic habits of life, who we defer to, who we don't defer to, who we think's important, who we don't think is important, whose lives matter, whose lives don't matter. It's a big system, and it's out there, and it's in here, and it's in here. That's a radicalizing realization that you carry individually all the things that you're against, and that it's a system, and that it lives in you as an unconscious set of biases and all of that. So that's a story that we have learned through our own. That's a story that tells what we have learned, is that what we have learned is that all of these oppressions out there, all the causes that all people are working on, they all come back and they connect, and they're all involved with systemic oppressions, and they're all out there. It's not other people that are the problem, but it's also us. And that's a story that we can tell anyone. Talk to anyone. I grew up in Youngstown, Ohio. I was just back at my 50th high school reunion. Half those people didn't go to college. They are typical white working class, non-college educated in Youngstown, Ohio. I didn't do a survey to find out who they voted for. I didn't want to find out who they voted for. I'm trying to reconnect with them. I didn't want to have that as a barrier. I could tell them from my own experience that what they worry about ultimately connects back to what everybody else is worrying about. That they have more in common with the fighters for black lives than they have with the bankers that decided that the steel mills of Youngstown, Ohio were no longer a profitable enterprise. So we started out being this enlightened wing of the establishment that believed in individual freedom, and we end up realizing that what we're up against is systems of oppression and that we're implicated in them. That's a story we can tell. Now, the second thing I think that we offer this broad movement of resistance is a certain insight that we have learned, and that is that we believe in building local and holistic communities. We think everybody should be part of a community. We think it's the isolation and fragmentation and atavism of our population that is one of the reasons why people are powerless, and one of the reasons why they turn to strong leaders somewhere out there, guys on white horses who are going to fix everything. So our organizational strategy has been for years to build local congregations. And so all the work that John has done here, that's important, important work. You can't go, well, there's building the church up, and then there's social justice. Building local communities that reach out to people, that include everybody, is part of the work of social justice. It's long-term base building, brick building, building. It's important work. We're a congregation's a special kind of organization. A congregation is not just a group of activists who meet together to plan an event, to have a meeting, to go on a march, right? But it's a whole community, elders, children. We don't just go to meetings together and march together in the street. We visit each other in the hospital when we're sick. I'll guarantee you, no one from Move On will come visit you when your mother dies. That's not their work. That's our work. We mourn each other at death. We go to the house of the new mother and wash the dishes so she can take a shower. We share our joys and sorrows. We're holistic. We deal with people's whole lives. And third thing we offer is that we know that overcoming systemic oppressions is not just a political cause, it's a personal and collective spiritual transformation. Because it's not other people, it's us too. So we have to learn how to grow into a new way of being. When hope and history rhyme, when that tidal wave of justice comes rolling in, we're going to be changed and shaken up and lose our footing and be tossed and tumbled. We'll be swept off our feet because every one of us has been formed down to the very marrow of our being to survive and thrive in an unjust society. Our skills are learning how to thrive and survive in an unjust society. So that's a very unsettling and upsetting experience. And how can we face it? What we need to do, what people need to do to face that kind of spiritual challenge is they need to worship. We need time to gather our strength. We need time to soften our hearts. We need time to concentrate our minds, to learn new things, to sing together. And in that worship service, we have time for that still small voice that is within each of us to speak to us. It is a great spiritual discipline, and I admire all of you for having it, to be able to sit still for 20 minutes and listen to somebody else talk. And not be free to argue with every sentence you don't like. Not to turn off not to hit the remote and go to another station. It's spiritual discipline. I'm not sure I have it, but anyway. Well, my colleague Barbara Merritt used to say, God knows who needs to be paid to go to church, because the true faithful do it for nothing, right? That was just her way of keeping us humble. Worship is self-care. Everybody talks about self-care, right, in the movements and all things. Take time for yourself. Well, self-care is not just bubble baths. Worship is self-care. Worship is community self-care. We need to do it. One, our story. Two, our understanding of systemic oppression. Our building our holistic communities. Three, worship. Four, we understand that this work is long-term, so it's really important for us to mold and form our children to anti-oppressive values. Indivisible does not have a Sunday school. The ACLU does not have a Sunday school. churches and congregations do, because we're forming children in anti-oppressive values. Here's the thing I think about sometimes is that, you know, people come and go in our churches, you know, often. We serve their needs for a couple of years and they move on. So it means over the time since 1985, there's probably been over 1 million children come through Unitarian Universalist Sunday schools. And we have taught all of them, as best we could, an ethical system in our 7 principles. And so wherever they go in life, no matter whether they're Unitarian or something else, somewhere back in their head there is this little phrase stuck in their brain that says, every person, every human being has inherent worth and dignity. And they will not know that from watching television. But someday it might come to them when they really need it. The reminder that every human being has inherent worth and dignity. They may be being asked to do something they ought not do, and they may have that to fall back on. Those are seeds we have planted. And our fifth is that we stand on the side of love. Love is our goal. Love is our ends. Love is our means. Love is our strategy. Love is our tactic. Love is our message. Love is our meme. We will try never to demonize the people who disagree with us, no matter what we think of their leaders. Love is our own heart's aspiration. Part of our spiritual transformation is learning how to let go of our hatred and learn to love, even to see through all the justifications we have for our hatred. Oh, I love everybody except them, but they deserve it. They think you do too. Love is what cramps our ability to love others. Our systems of oppression are that cramp our ability to love others, that stop us from seeing each other, and that close our ears to their stories, and that deaden us to their feelings and blind us to each other. Love is how we heal ourselves and heal others and heal this world. So, blessings on all your work here. Blessings on your hopes and on your children. And I ask you to live with love and determination this weekend to be back here next Sunday. Amen.